Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips of the PC. It is Saturday, the 19th day of 2019, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Here comes the news. Yes, as you've heard, our friend Dave Enright is one step ahead of the law, somewhere in the southwest, hiding among the mesas and the badlands.
Away from the storm.
Away from the storm. We hate him.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Michael, God bless him, comes in to do the job, and we're grateful. All right, to the news, eventually. If I can get my fingers to work. Yes, apparently I can. All good things must come to an end, Microsoft says. It probably has no idea how poignant that is in light of recent Windows news. The company has just started the countdown timer for the end of life of Windows 7, encouraging users to upgrade to Windows 10. But in doing so, not only will users be saying goodbye to what was until last month the most used Windows version, it will also be saying hello to the headaches that Windows 10 updates bring. It has taken more than 6 years and 2.5 versions of Windows to finally dethrone Windows 7. Launched in late 2009, the version of the operating systems sits in between two widely considered flop Windows releases, Windows Vista and Windows 8. Its colorful and glassy arrow theme, narrow start menu, and iconic startup sound are probably still the things that most people associate Windows with. And some might continue to do so even beyond January 14th, 2020. Beyond that date, Microsoft will no longer be providing official support or even critical security flaws to Windows fixes. It'll still have security flaws. It won't have security fixes to Windows 7. But it's not like the OS will completely stop working right then and there. Even Microsoft admits, perhaps begrudgingly, that Windows 7 will continue to function. You'll just be less protected. Of course, if you want to get just not just new features, but also security updates, you'll have to upgrade to Windows 10. Given Microsoft's wonderful track record lately in regards to updates, that might not be exactly be a comforting thought, especially for business owners who rely on keeping their PCs functional, even through updates. This looks like an excellent opportunity for Macs and Chromebooks and Linux, but we'll see. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bytes. With a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Windows 7 support ends next year. Your choices are, I'll stop using it immediately. I've got a year, no rush. I'll never stop using it. And big deal. So far, 26 of you have voted, and big deal is the number one choice. Now, I know you'll have more to say about this. So if you scroll down on the right under Fascinating Stuff, you will see the forums. The second forum down is the poll discussion. Currently, at least, the first item under poll discussions is 19 Jan 19, Windows 7 support ends next year. So I know you'll have a lot to say about this, so please join us there. And definitely, if you want to talk about this or dang near anything, give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
What's interesting is they stopped selling Windows 7 home suites in retail stores in October of 2013 and pre-installed in computers in October of 2014.
Yeah.
So if you bought a new computer in the last 4 years, you're almost forced to get Windows 10.
Yeah, in the forums, Hot Dog is saying that he's not sure the risk of malware will increase much. I have to disagree with that. You're right. Mostly the people writing malware generally target the operating systems most commonly used. However, once Microsoft stops providing any updates for Windows 7, it's going to become an immediate prime target.
And 7 is still commonly used. So
it's still close to 50%. So, you know, there's no way that they are going to stop trying to hit it, particularly since there is now no protection from the operating system anymore.
And one of the things we've seen is that threats are changing, that it's much easier for the bad guys to write an ad that says you're infected, you know, call this phone number. And so being able to change that ad now saying that your Windows is no longer supported, call this phone number.
Call this phone number, right. Yeah.
In fact, in the last couple of weeks, there was a huge surge of fake phone calls purporting to be from Apple. Some people were getting 5 or 6 phone calls a day. It got so bad, Channel 10 News came and interviewed us at our shop, that it was just amazing. So we joked about that, you know, a month or two ago. There was a big raid in India, and they shut down several call centers, like 2 dozen call centers, arrested a couple dozen people for tech support scams. So then there's the lull. And then there's a surge when someone comes in and picks up the slack.
Right. Right. Yeah. So you really, if you're still running Windows 7, you know, God bless you. Do what you want to do. But be aware that support is going to get scarcer. And that includes us. As Microsoft has demonstrated in the past, they remove support material from their website when they stop supporting a product. I don't know why. It's not like the disk space actually costs them anything, but they do. And so we will be less able to help people with Windows 7 as well as everybody
else. It's their way to nudge you out the door.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. If support goes away from everybody, then you're much more likely to upgrade to something else. And maybe that will be another Windows machine. Maybe that will be a Chromebook. Maybe that will be Linux. Maybe that will be a Mac. Who knows? Anyway, don't forget, you can give us a call, 585-966-CHAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. And in the meantime, we have a couple of questions that we got earlier from, I believe that says Ken. I threw away the envelope because I'm an idiot. But thank you for the stuff you gave us. But here are a couple of questions. First question, I would like to better understand all the settings in my Chromebook. Can you suggest accessible printed documentation, books, etc.? Well, there are any number of books that are available. I personally wrote 3 of them that are available on as Kindle editions on Amazon. There's the Dummy series, you know, Chromebook for Dummies, that sort of thing. Certainly there is the local Rochester Google's user group. We meet the first Thursday of every month at St. John's Meadows from 7 to 9. And people come and bring their Chromebooks and ask questions, and we give them help. And it's a fun time. So that's the first Thursday of every month. Lots of there are lots of things online. There's a Chromebook help. You know, if you hit Control question mark, it brings up things like keyboard shortcuts. So that's helpful to give you a little bit of a start of the way things go. But a Chromebook lets you do so many things. If you're talking about the Chromebook itself, it's fairly easy to run. But if you're talking about all the things you can do with a Chromebook, like I said, I wrote a book called I Just Bought a Chromebook. Help, I Just Bought a Chromebook. I also wrote one on Google Docs and that. So if you're using Google Suite, Google Docs, Google Sheets, Google Presentation, you may find that you can do dang near everything you want to do. Like I said, I've written 3 books on Google Docs. It certainly is useful for pretty much everything. But you do need to learn a slightly different way of doing things. But that's doable. And his other question is, he's still running a compact Presario running Windows 7. And he has a BIOS password issue. He said he set the supervisor password, which required him to enter it at each boot up prior proceeding to the Windows login screen. Now at boot up, no password is required. It proceeds directly to the Windows login screen. However, pressing F10 to enter the BIOS, he must enter the password. He said he's tried resetting the user password as well as set the user, the supervisor password, which has no effect. I don't know. It is quite likely that the problem is the Compact Presario is a very, very old machine. And it may well be that your problem is that you've got a dying battery. Those old Chromebooks had a Chromebooks. Those old Compact Presarios had a little battery in them, and that battery keeps the BIOS alive. And when that battery dies, everything in the BIOS gets reset. So it is very possible that the battery is dead in that BIOS in that PC, and therefore the BIOS no longer remembers the things that it has to do. Now so you might want to take it to somebody who could change that battery for you. I don't remember enough about the Compact Presario, frankly. That's a very old machine. I don't remember enough about the Compact Presario to know if the battery is changeable or if it was soldered in. But in general, that's something you should have someone look at, and that should help you along.
Generally, if they are removable batteries, it's a CR2032 wafer battery about the size of a quarter.
Yeah.
Man,
everything uses that battery. Yeah.
Now, the new Macs use a BR2032.
Oh, well. Of course they do.
Because the Apple has to be different.
Well, yeah. It's the same size, but it's a longer shelf life, which is interesting.
Oh, it does it. A longer shelf life. Not a longer use life.
I think it's a little of both.
Okay. Well, if it's the same size and it's the same voltage, then why not? You know,
yep.
Right? But yeah, I just bought a 6-pack of them because I realized they have so many things that use them.
It uses carbon monofluoride instead of magnesium dioxide.
Well, of course, that makes sense. Carbon monofluoride holds a charge longer.
Yeah.
So it would have a longer shelf life. That makes sense to me. But yeah, Chromebooks are wonderful devices, I personally believe. The big thing about them that you have to do is you're going to learn a slightly different way of doing things. That's a simple fact, and there's no way around that. You're gonna have a different.
But it will be pretty familiar to you if you've already been using the Chrome web browser. So that's
right.
One thing you can do on your current computer is install Chrome, use that as your exclusive browser for a while. And while you learn the Chrome browser, that will make the transition to a Chromebook easier.
Right. And there are lots and lots of add-ons, extensions for the Chrome browser that all work on the Chromebook. And it's real easy and real fast and real simple. It's an amazing little device. I open the lid and it boots up in a few seconds, and I can do everything I want to do. Like I said, I don't know your way of working, right? And your way of working will change. The way you do things will change, not necessarily the things you do. The things you do will pretty much remain the same. You're going to do word processing and spreadsheets and databases and surfing and mail and blah, 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 blah. But so all of that will, in fact, essentially remain the same. But there's no way that the way you do things will stay the same. That will change. But I found, as Steve said, by the fact that I use the Google browser on my Linux box, and the fact that I started using the Google suite of things early on, I found a transition to a Chromebook to be ridiculously easy. So that was kind of nice. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 20 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's it's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
I was waiting for Dave there.
And at 25 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites. Don't forget, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, Archandra in the YouTube chat explains to us that in the CR2032 nomenclature, the first two digits, CR is chemistry. The 20 means it's a 20 millimeter in diameter, and the 32 means it's 3.2 millimeters thick.
Nicely done, nice. Sir.
Thank you, Archandra.
Well, I'd like to thank the dozens and dozens of people who sent me this next article. And I do appreciate, I do appreciate it very much when people alert me to things like this. Have I been pwned? The breach notification service that serves as a bellwether for the security of login credentials has just gotten its hands on its biggest data haul ever, a list that includes almost 773 million unique email addresses and 21 million unique passwords that were used to log into third-party sites.
Out of 2.7 billion addresses in the list, he had to weed through and find the unique ones.
Right.
Because
exactly
Troy
right.
Hunt is a really good guy.
He's an amazing guy. According to Have I Been Pwned founder Troy Hunt, the monster list is a compilation of many smaller lists taken from past breaches and have been in wide circulation over the past week. It was also posted to the Mega File Sharing site, so pretty much anybody on the planet could download it. At least one of the included breaches dated back to 2015. Dubbed Collection Number 1, not to be confused with Individual Number 1, the aggregated data was likely scraped together to serve as a master list that hackers could use in credential stuffing attacks. These attacks use automated scripts to inject credentials from one breached website into a different website in hopes the holders reuse the same passwords. The 773 million email addresses and 21 million passwords easily beat Have I Been Pwned's previous record breach notification that contained 711 million records. But these are another 773 totally unique addresses. But there are other things that make this latest installment stand out. In all, it contains 1.16 billion email password combinations. That means the list covers the same people multiple times, but in many cases with different passwords. Also significant, the list contained in 12,000 separate files that take up more than 87 gigabytes of disk space has 2.69 billion rows, many of which contain duplicate entries that Hunt had to clean up. About 663, there's a guy who's following his passion. About 663 million of the addresses have been listed in previous Have I Been Pwned notifications, meaning 140 million of the addresses have never been seen by the service before. Hunt said that some of his own credentials were included in Wednesday's notification, although none were currently in use. Have I Been Pwned has now begun the non-trivial task of emailing more than 768,000 individuals who signed up for notifications and nearly 40,000 people who monitor domains.
I got mine.
Yep. Anyone who hasn't signed up can still check the status of an email address at the Have I Been Pwned website, which I believe we already have up listed up there. People will receive notifications to or browse to the site and find themselves there. And it will be one more little reminder about how our personal data are misused, Hunt wrote. If, like me, you're on that list, people who are intent on breaking into your online accounts are circulating it between themselves and looking to take advantage of any shortcuts you may be taking with your online security. Hunt said that one of the questions he gets asked the most is if he will divulge the password that accompanies the email address in a breach. He has steadfastly refused for a variety of good reasons. First, pairing usernames and passwords would undoubtedly make a service a major target of hackers. It would also require him to store passwords in clear text, which is something no site should ever do. Have I Been Pwned does allow, and so many places do that. Have I Been Pwned does allow people to use the site to check if a specific text string has ever shown up in a breach notification, but for obvious reasons, it decouples the password from the email addresses that use it. So you can look up both your email address and your passwords, but they are not linked on the site. And so our question to you, of course, is how often do you reuse passwords? And what are you thinking when you do? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free at 1-800-790-0415.
And if you manage a domain, in fact, I just found this and going to have to set it up for our office, you can set up a global notification so that if your domain shows up in any list, you'll get notified. So if anyone else in your company is on the list, you can put yourself on the notification list, but this is kind of nice to put any domain on the notification list.
Put that up as a thing, will you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So have I been pwned, P-W-N-E-D, have I been P-W-N-E-D.com? And Steve, well, we've already got that somewhere on our list, on our notices, but you can type in your email address and see if you've been pwned. And type in all your email addresses. And, of course, if you're reusing a password, if you've used the same password twice, that's not the best practice, he said politely.
I had a customer this morning who paid with a Marriott rewards card, said, oh, did you hear about the Marriott breach? 500 million records were lost, and you should change your password immediately. I use the same password on every site. Cringe. So I looked her up on Have I Been Pwned. One of her addresses is in 5 breaches. So far, the other address has not been breached. But her old address, that's been breached. Changed the passwords immediately.
Well, don't forget, Troy Hunt at Have I Been Pwned has not yet finished installing all of the addresses from that 773 million. So it is certainly not an impossibility that he or she is going to find themselves on that list. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Andy from Greece, New York. Hi, Andy. What's up?
Hey, Nick. Just a quick thing going back to the gentleman who thought he might have a bad system or BIOS battery.
Yes.
If I remember correctly, and this is going back a ways, but when that battery goes, your system clock and date go haywire.
Yes.
So if you power the unit down and bring it back up, your system clock goes back to 1-1 whatever.
Well, yes and no, because with Windows, most versions of Windows now will set the time based on the internet time servers.
Yeah, so for a half a second there, you might see your date wrong, but then it resets it over the internet.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that you're right, that used to be a fairly good indicator that you needed a new battery, but nowadays that's bypassed by the operating system.
And you can disconnect from the internet and give that a try.
Right.
Turn your machine off, unplug from the internet, turn it back on, and see if the clock stays zeroed. January 1st, 1980 is a common zero point. On the Mac, there's December 29th, 1959 is one of the zero points. And the only thing we can guess is that's the birth date of someone who was on the design team.
Right.
Although being born in 1959 makes them pretty old for a original Mac developer who were all in their 20s.
Right.
In 1980.
That's exactly right.
I used to notice it a lot because I shut the computer off I would turn it down, but then I would kill the power bar.
Right.
And which took the power away from it. Because if you left it plugged in, even though you turned the computer off, if there was still power to the system, a lot of times the clock would stay where it was supposed to.
Right, exactly right.
Power bar, now you're living on the battery. And if the battery's not there, you definitely know because it doesn't come up with it.
Yeah, so if you do use a power strip to turn off everything, you probably go through your battery a lot faster than you would by not. Although that's the old debate, how many people even turn their computer off anymore?
Boy, ain't that the truth.
Yeah.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah, but you're right. Nowadays, it doesn't much matter because the BIOS isn't is less prone to needing any sort of battery lifeline, and like we said, they get most of their ephemeral stuff from the internet anyway, like the date and time. So
But this guy was specifically looking at an old compact model where that might still be the case.
Right. If he's not on the internet, if he unplugs himself from the internet, he would certainly see the battery, the date stay at January 1st. But if he's on the internet, he might not see that.
Yeah, and all it is a quick way to figure out whether it's the battery or not without having to mess around with it.
Right.
So if you lose your clock when you power back up, it's time to go get a CR32.
Right. There you go. Thanks,
right.
Andy.
No problem.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah. So if you're finding that your system is acting a little wonky and it's a very old system, you might just want to shut it down, disconnect it from the internet, and power it back up again and see if the date stays at January 1st, 1980. If it does, then you know you need a new battery, although the battery can, as it's dying, the result is...
Unforeseeable, or...?
I don't know. I forget what the word is, but basically they're saying we don't know what's going to happen. If the battery's not quite dead yet, but it's dying, there are unpredictable results.
I'm not dead yet.
Right.
This one did admit it, no?
But that's so. Yeah, definitely. You want to make sure that your system is running well. Newer machines don't seem to be prone to that sort of thing. They don't use a battery backup for much at all, and so it's not much of an issue.
Yeah, because most people don't turn their computer off, and there's a continuous internet connection to reset the clock if you need to.
Right. So, and many people don't set the BIOS password or the supervisor password. BIOS password means that you cannot change the BIOS without that password. You cannot make changes to the BIOS. Supervisor password means you can't boot the system without that password. They're different from each other. And the nice thing about both is that if you're in an environment where there are other people who might get their hands on your machine, like in a dormitory or whatever, then you definitely want to use those. Because one of the things that you want to do when you get a machine is you go into the BIOS and you turn off booting from the floppy or from USB. Then you set the BIOS password, which now means that if somebody comes up to your machine and sticks a CD in your drive and turns it on, it won't start with their operating system. Or if they stick a USB port drive in it with an operating system on it, it won't start. And they won't be able to change that unless they know your password. Now, a supervisor password is different. If you boot up Windows itself, it actually asks for a password before it goes to the screen itself, where you should still be asking for your password. So it's two passwords to get in. And, of course, you should make those different passwords. And, of course, your BIOS password should be yet another different password, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, on the passwords. Never use the same password twice. Not ever. It's just a very bad, very bad practice.
And
I know that people like to do it because it's so simple. Don't do it.
And the danger is nothing you do wrong. It's the other end. The other end gets breached and loses your password.
Right.
So you know, we were talking about the Marriott password recently, this Collection One, where the passwords were breached. If you use the same password on Amazon and Citibank and PayPal and you know, Joe's blog that you post on every now and then. So if one of them gets breached, now the bad guys know to try those same passwords on all those other services that might have money behind them.
Right. And think about it. Most people use the same email address for all of their logins, which makes sense. But if you've used the same username and password for multiple systems, then if they get any one of them, they've got all of them. And that's very bad for you. So make sure that you deal with that. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Bob from Henrietta, New York. Hi, Bob. What's up?
Suggestion for the guy with the BIOS problem. Many motherboards will have a jumper or something that you can short on the board itself in order to reset it.
Right. And I honestly don't remember way back to the Compaq.
Well, this has been, you have seen this on motherboards for decades. So yep. there's a very good chance he might have something like that he can try. He'd have to consult, you know, look up the documentation for that specific model board and so forth.
Yeah, but. Right. That's what I was about to say, because what I was saying was I don't remember way back to the compact as to where that jumper is.
Oh, I don't know either.
So he'd have to,
Common feature among many motherboards, and if he's capable of taking it apart and looking into it, it might be a solution for him.
Yep. Good thought, Bob. Thanks.
Okay, welcome. Yep. Bye.
There's a similar facility on the Mac called the firmware password, which will prevent it from booting anything other than the standard internal disk. So, again, the bad guys can't come along and try to boot their own disk.
Right.
And even if you put a different internal disk in, it knows that and won't boot from it anymore.
Nice.
But we have had customers, in fact, I have one in the shop right now, where the firmware password got turned on and no one remembers doing it.
Oh, yeah.
And so Apple has a procedure they need to follow to and the big thing is you have to provide proof of purchase to prove you own this computer so they can release a custom firmware patch to remove that firmware. And the customer we're working with now, the computer was purchased like 8 years ago, and the company's been bought 3 or 4 times since then, and no one has the original receipt anymore.
Yep. Keep your receipts, people. Keep them handy with the computer. One of the places I used to work, we used to attach, we used to buy them by the hundreds, little plastic pouches with stick-em backs, and you stick one on the back of the thing, put all the documentation for that machine in that thing. Yep. You know, the original paperwork, any work that was done, so that when, you know, if we ever had to take a computer to somebody, we could say, look, here's the stuff.
Yep.
That was done on this machine. And it sounds like a silly thing to do, because you never lose documentation, do you? But just on the off chance that you can't lay your hands on it right away because you've moved 3 times and cleaned your room once and what's her name, Marie Kondo, has gotten into your head and you've thrown away everything but 30 books, that's pornographically bad.
Yeah. You just get a bigger house if you need more books.
That's exactly right.
And of course, you need more books.
I have to say, it turns out that Hulu is starting a series, the George R. R. Martin Wildcard series.
Ah.
They're doing 2 series of it. So I went to go read the books again, and I had to dig past 3 tables full of books and 3 rows of books in a bookshelf to find the first volume. And I thought, I might have a problem.
And I thought I was like, I don't have any room on my shelves anymore.
Yeah. And I've been buying, and for the last 10 years, I've been buying nothing but e-books. So it's gotten to be, and that's a problem for me too, because I read e-books on everything. So I've got books on Google Books and on Kindle Books and on Nook, and it's just, I don't remember where anything is anymore, and nobody's written a utility that makes it easy to find where you put books. So I'm going to have to start a database of where I have all my books. It's getting ridiculous. It's just getting ridiculous.
There was a program for the Mac, and I'm not going to remember it now. It was a database that you would scan. It had a barcode scanner facility, and you would scan all your books and records and VHS tapes and Delicious Library. That was the name of it. And it even had a facility where you could lend something to somebody and put their name in so they could check it out.
Yep.
And then you know who I lent that to, because I swear we've got movies that I know we bought that we lent them some money and they haven't come back yet.
So it's a library program.
Yeah,
Delicious Library. I wonder if it's still around.
I actually wrote one of those long, long, long ago, back when I had a Canon. Was it a Canon Cat? It was a scanner. It was a little hand scanner. I don't think so. The Canon Cat was a different device entirely. Yeah. But it was an operating system that ran Forth. But it had there's a little scanner that was shaped like a cat. I can't remember the name of it. And I wrote a routine that did that. But I haven't had a scanner on my computer, and I can't tell you how long.
So now you hold it up to the barcode up to the camera that's built in.
Right. Yeah, I just never rewrote the thing.
Delicious Library from Delicious Monster. It's still around.
Version 3?
Yeah.
Is there a Linux version?
I'm looking.
When you have, well, and then, of course, there's the, I have to put in 72,000 books.
Yeah.
May have to hire a person to do that for me.
Looks like this one's Mac only.
There you go. I'm sure there's a million programs like it for Linux or online things for the Chromebook or
you
whatever.
You got SQL in there? Just write it yourself.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. I still, probably still got the code from the old one.
Did you hear about the SQLite bug?
No.
Oh, it was on Security Now a couple weeks ago. Every version of SQLite has got this horrible oversight bug. And many companies include SQLite with their stuff. Thunderbird uses it. So Steve was saying he scanned his computer and found four different installations of it. Let me find what the exploit bug is. What was it called? It had a cool name.
There is a bug report.
They joke that that's the best. The first thing you have to do when you find one of these bugs is make a cool name.
Right, right. The Magellan vulnerability?
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. Oh, look at that. Tencent is one of the companies that does a lot of that. They have a Blade security team, and they did it. And it allows an attacker to run malicious code on the victim's computer or leak program memory or cause program crashes. It's embedded in thousands upon thousands of apps.
That won't get updated.
That won't get updated, right. Chromium-based browsers like Chrome and Vivaldi and Opera and Brave and the new Edge are all affected. Most email programs are affected. It's bunches of stuff. Google Home. Firefox is affected because it has a local SQLite database. A lot of people are using SQLite. SQLite is a free, simple, little, light database that does, database stuff, right? So, and it's free. And many, 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 many programs include it.
And so
many apps include it.
Yeah. And so it's real easy to chain into... you accidentally visit a malicious website that can then take advantage of the malicious the SQL bug. Although I found a post on Naked Security that the author of SQLite is yelling at them for releasing it.
I see that. Yeah, he's been upset about that. But you know what? The reality is, if in fact you're going to create a device, a system of some sort like SQLite, it behooves you to keep up to date. And I'm sorry, but that's the truth. You know, I've written a whole bunch of code that I don't maintain anymore, but I haven't handed it out to anybody.
Right.
And when I'm using it for my own stuff, like I wrote a whole online database to keep track of all my 3D printing filaments and the stuff that I make with it and how much filament I have left and all of that other hoopla. And if it doesn't work to somebody else's specifications, I don't care. It's my database. You know, I don't care what you think of it. But if you're going to create something that you release to the masses, then you have an obligation to keep it up to date and to keep it secure.
Especially when it's being used on everything.
Right. Right. When so many billions and billions of programs and apps use SQLite, you have a kind of an obligation to keep it working. And it's pretty much every operating system and every software program that's out there uses SQLite in one form or another. And that includes the Chrome OS and Windows and Linux and the Mac and everything else.
And the original creator's report was that it's not really a vulnerability. Some clever gray hats found a way to get remote code execution using maliciously crafted SQL.
So it's a vulnerability.
Yeah, if you allow random internet users to run arbitrary code on your system, you're in trouble. Well, yeah, you accidentally go to a malicious website and it runs random arbitrary code on your computer.
Right.
That's the whole definition of vulnerability.
Yeah, that is a vulnerability. That's exactly right.
This isn't a vulnerability as long as you don't go anywhere. So you'll be fine.
Right, right, right. It's the same thing when people say, well, I don't go anywhere with Windows 7. Really? Are you connected to the internet at all? So remember the idea of worms? They're still out there.
Yep.
At any rate, the idea is that these things need to be updated. And see, this is just another one of those situations where you didn't do anything wrong. It's not your fault. The software that you use on your machine isn't at fault. The software that the software on your machine uses is what's at fault. But that doesn't matter. You're still the one who gets hit. It's a very painful and very sad thing to realize. But we're all connected nowadays. And that means that even if you don't go anywhere or do anything bad or unusual, the likelihood that you will get hit by one of these continues to grow. That's the thing.
The QCAT.
QCAT. That was it. That was it.
I think I had one of those too.
Yeah.
I think we have one here at the station somewhere, actually.
Yeah.
A little
scanner. They gave them away by the millions, as I recall. And then everybody bought one because they were cheap and usable.
Because I remember when I first came here, we were putting stuff into the computer system. I think it was CDs. We're putting CDs into the system and creating a database, and we had one hooked up to the computer in the music library. Yep. It didn't work, but we had it there.
But you had it there, yeah. Well, that was the problem with the QCAT, and one of the reasons that it's no longer around. It was nice, but it was not tremendously useful in that it didn't run well every day. But yeah, so there's a lot, and now you're right, and Steve is right. They're superseded by the fact that you can just hold stuff up to the camera, and it's gonna do the same thing. My Pixel,
I can never hold my hand steady enough.
Well, right,
yeah, I had that problem too. It's like keep it still. Like I can't
keep it still. My Pixel phone. When you go into the camera, one of the you can have all these little filters and things. One of them is called Lens, and it's the old Google Lens. So if I use that, I can scan barcodes, and I can read text on a screen or on a thing, or I can recognize something, and it'll bring me up similar images, or it'll say these are a certain type of shoe or a certain type of coat or whatever it happens to be, and you can do some pretty interesting things with that as well. But getting all those things to work with a little program you've written is a little more difficult than it used to be. But the QCAT was a very cool toy. So was the Canon Cat, which I thought was the name of it before. The Canon Cat was a little computer from 1987, and it was a $1,500 computer, and it looked a lot like a dedicated word processor, but it did some really. It was actually Jeff Raskin who created it.
Oh yeah,
yeah, and he's the guy who originated the Macintosh project at Apple. After he left Apple, he created this thing, and the basic idea was you sit down to this machine, and it wasn't even turned on yet, right? And you sat down, and you started typing, and if you started typing. If you press the letter first, it assumed you were word processing and opened up the word processor. And if you typed the number first, it assumed you wanted a spreadsheet and opened up the spreadsheet first. So it was really pretty cool, actually. And it was a very simple and very easily usable thing. And of course, this is the early 80s, so it had a 9-inch black and white monitor, a single 3.5-inch floppy disk, an IBM Selectric keyboard, used a Motorola 68000 like the original Mac.
I wonder if he named it in honor of the Commodore PET.
Oh, that's a nice idea. I don't know.
The PET was 77.
Right, and this is the Canon Cat.
In 87.
Right. It had a 1200 baud modem. A 1200 baud modem, baby.
Yep, I'm screaming.
That was the thing in the day.
It's about as fast as I could read.
I said this before. Yep. I wrote a program in Forth. I wrote a terminal program. And at 300 baud, it was great. And at 1200 baud, it was great. And then when I got a 2400 baud modem, I had to rewrite the whole program to save stuff to disk because it came over faster than I could read.
Yep.
And it really kind of made me angry because this was a program that was running perfectly, thank you very much. And now I would go ripping through stuff, although it turned out to be better, of course, as I would rip through stuff and it would end up on disk and then I could disconnect, which meant that my wife could now use the phone. And then I could, you people, you puppies, you don't know the struggle. It was real, people.
I actually rewired all the phones in my house so I could unplug the rest of the phones when I was on the modem.
Yeah, there you go. Very nice.
I first got a computer in 1996. It was Windows 95.
Yeah.
I don't think we used a phone for like...
Yeah.
And for a long time, you'd get a second phone line so you could be on the computer and not, you know, hear your spouse yelling at you about you needing the phone. And that was how we justified high-speed internet in the early days, because you could give up the second phone line.
Right.
And so we're actually saving money, honey, I swear.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly.
And when high-speed internet was 10 megabit.
Right. And, of course, the Canon Cat ran in fourth.
Yeah.
So that was good. But I remember, and of course, you know, we thought we had the greatest computer stuff back in those days. I remember at one point saying to my wife, and of course she still reminds me of this, I had an Apple II with a full 64K of RAM, 2 5.25-inch floppy drives, a 9-inch green screen monitor, and a thermal printer.
Yep.
And I remember saying to my wife, this is it. I will never need another thing. Boy, was that a mistake!
For a year.
Never need another thing for about 6 months. But to this day, if I say, you know, I'm thinking of buying a new Chromebook, wait a minute. Yeah.
All the plug holes are full. I need a new one.
Yeah, right.
With more plug holes. Nowadays, the computers have fewer connections on them because everything is wireless.
Yes, exactly right. And, of course, they all have different connectors now, so now you need to buy all new stuff
because
all the old stuff doesn't work anymore.
Well, USB-A lasted about 20 years, so let's hope USB-C lasts about 20 years.
Yeah, that'd be nice. My phone now is USB-C. And if I get a new Chromebook, it's going to be USB-C. Yep.
I remember the shift from serial and parallel to USB-A, and that was painful. Now, 98 is when that started.
Yep.
The iMac was the first popular computer to come with USB only. It didn't have serial or parallel, and that really pushed the industry. Intel created USB, and no one was using it because we're so used to serial and parallel.
Right.
I remember when we first got a Windows XP, we still had a printer with a...
Electronics port?
Connection on it,
yeah.
And we pulled the thing out, and I'm hooking the thing up, and I'm looking around for the port. I'm like, where the heck do I plug the printer in?
Yep.
Oh, we got to get a new one. Okay.
Yep. That's exactly right. I remember the days of Centronics ports and RS-232 serial.
Well, SCSI, there was a version of SCSI that used a DB25.
Right.
And serial printers used a DB25. So we'd have customers that would plug their SCSI hard drive into their printer port.
Right.
And fry both devices.
Both devices, exactly right. And as you remember, Steve Jobs tried to get people to pronounce it sexy.
Yep.
Because nothing on
the Mac should be SCSI.
Right. But the SCI interface, the Small Computer Systems Interface, SCSI, is properly called SCSI. Which really did. It actually made him angry. We were at one of PC Expo something, and I did say, oh, SCSI port. And he said, sexy. And I had to stop for a minute. Oh, you mean that's what you're calling this? Okay, that's not going to catch on. And it didn't.
And we're still using SCSI somewhat. Some of the latest devices are USB attached SCSI, or UAS, or UASP.
Right.
Yep.
All right, that music tells me you've wasted an entire hour of your life with this nonsense. But don't go away, you're going to get a whole nother chance to do it all again, because we'll be back after a slightly longer break with a whole lot more of the longest running computer show in the known universe. We're going to bring back Steve Ray, we're going to bring back Michael Oden, we're going to bring back Nick Francesco, and we're also bringing Sexy back. So stay tuned, and we'll be back on the longest running computer show in the known universe. Right here on the truly great and truly grateful to you, that we can continue to be member-supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you on the other side.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District, Jazz 90.1.
Online at jazz901.org.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Sound Bites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Wooten.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, you're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. It's Sound Bites right here on the truly great and truly grateful to you that we continue to be member-supported Jazz 90.1. You can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415. And as you heard, Dave Enright, one step ahead of the law somewhere in the Southwest, and Michael Oden, God bless him, mushed his sled team in here this morning to take over the duties of the important duties of actually getting and keeping us on the air. all right. Here we go. When Google first started introducing browser-based productivity tools, such as Docs and Sheets, they had something in common with much of what the company offers. They were free. And in fact, they still are. But in 2007, Google launched a premium edition of its Google Apps services, now known as G Suite, for $50 per user per year. In subsequent years, it added a $5 per month option and advanced versions of the suite at higher prices, but it's never instituted a simple price hike akin to Netflix raising its monthly fee, which they're doing now as well. $2, I think.
Amazon Prime went up another little bit, too.
Prime went up. Everybody's going up.
Just my Prime auto Prime payment just hit this week. And wait, that was like $5 more.
Yeah. But it's, it never had done that until now. G Suite Basic, the version for individual and organizations that don't manage much, demand much in the way of management tools, is going from $5 to $6 a month per user. G Suite Business, which adds functionality such as the ability to set retention policies for email, will go from $10 to $12. Only G Suite Enterprise, which is $25 per user per month, will stay unchanged. The original $50 per year price for G Suite Basic, which was already only available in certain countries, will disappear. Annual contracts will still be available, but at the same rate as monthly plans. The new pricing takes effect on April 2nd. Existing subscribers will only pay the higher price when their current agreements end. So if you wanted to be a G Suite user, now's the time to do it, because on April 2nd, the prices are going up. Why charge more? Well, Google says it's been aggressive about adding new apps, features, and benefits, such as increased storage over the years, so the suite will still offer plenty of value even with the new pricing. G Suite's principal rival remains the product that's dominated productivity since the 90s, Microsoft Office. It's tough to compare price, though. Office 365 offers six variants that don't map to G Suite's three versions. There's $5 a month Office 365 variant, but it's for workers who mostly need email and doesn't even include Word, Excel, or PowerPoint. G Suite targets companies that are all in on the cloud and happy with apps that run in a browser. Office, even in the Office 365 subscription version, still involves downloadable software with tons of features. That's such a fundamental distinction. I can't imagine any organization choosing one over the other based on pricing issues. So how much do you pay for your Office suite? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
I've had several customers this week where we've told them they're running an ancient version of Microsoft Office and they could upgrade or shift to one of the free suites and say, yeah, we've mostly switched to Google Docs.
Yeah.
But I've got that Office 2008 on there just in case.
Just in case.
It's not going to work much longer.
That's right. I have been an advocate of Not Lotus. Oh, for Pete's sake. The free office suite.
Libra.
Libra office. Thank you. Jeez.
Starts crackers. With an L. Close.
Starts with an L. That's important. I was close to it. It's been a long week.
Same number of letters.
Same number of letters. Libra office for a very long time, and I still like it a lot, but I have switched almost exclusively over to Google, the Google suite, the free version, because the ability to get at all of my data anywhere on the planet from any one of my devices is very seductive, frankly, and I'm happy to do it. So, you know, right now on my phone or on my Chromebook, I could look up stuff I wrote at home, and it's great. It's great. Pretty nice stuff. All right. Our next caller is Lynn from Clymer, New York. Hiya, Lynn. What's up?
Well, a lot less known than was, say, 6 hours ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't personally have to deal with it this week because I've turned my ankle, so I can't even get around the house without using some sort of a device of one kind or another.
Sure.
Anyway, the reason I called, I'm curious. I got Windows 10 on my big Dell machine, and what I was curious about, I believe there's a connector on the back of that that is kind of L-shaped, and I believe it's a high-speed video audio link that I can run for, if I got the cable, I can run it over to a flat-screen television, and I can use that as a second monitor, I believe. Am I correct, or all wet?
I don't know of an L-shaped video connector.
Yeah, nor do I.
It's not.
Well, I think there's like four. Well, I must admit, I haven't got my nose in there real good, but no, it looks like it maybe four to six connectors in a row, and then one or two off at a.
Oh, the composite video. They're not. It's not one connector. It's a series of connectors in an L shape.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So.
Sorry, I described.
No,
that
it's okay.
Wrong.
That's okay.
Yeah, they're RCA jacks, and there's composite. So there's a single yellow jack for video and then red and white for audio. And then there was a higher quality version that was component, which had red, green, and blue jacks for video and then red and white for audio.
Mm.
So there could be three jacks for composite video or five jacks for component video.
Am I remembering correctly that there used to be a website that I used to go to? I don't know that I ever bought Monoprice or something.
Yep.
Yeah, sure, Monoprice.
Yeah, and they had, I think, long cables for that I could run from where my computer is clear across and up to a widescreen television, I think. That'll upscale to that flat screen, won't it?
Well, the television might, but I think component is only 540p, so it was the old VGA standard, 640 by 480. And so your television might upscale it, but it's going to get bitty and look pretty bad.
Yeah, the thing is, you may see this on the back of some TVs. There's component in, and then there's the digital, a little
DVI.
Digital. Right, DVI. And then there's HDMI.
And some of them even had VGA.
And some of them have VGA. And each of those is a different resolution, a different quality video, and often a different speed.
Mm.
You could certainly do it, but it's not going to look, particularly if you've bought a high-end TV, almost specifically in order to get gorgeous.
Well, it'd be a Vizio of whatever, you know, something probably around 40 inches.
Right. It's really not going to look all that good.
Yeah, those are the old analog connectors that were around before we switched to digital connectors and higher resolutions.
Well, do I remember correctly that you can call into Monoprice?
Probably.
I do know that you can. They have a website, monoprice.com, where you can buy cables and 3D printers and things. So,
I remember I got on the website a time or two and was looking at the whole. They had a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing company. They've got a lot of things there. They do have a phone number. They have phone numbers on their website, and you can call from 9 to 6 Pacific time. They're in Rancho Cucamonga. but you can call them. They have a 900 number and an 800 number.
I called for 800. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, and I am seeing that with digital component, it can carry up to 1080p. So it depends on what the output of the device has.
Right. It depends on two things.
Yeah, the output of the computer and the input on the television.
Right. What they will handle.
Well, if I call Monoprice, I got a feeling if I tell them I got a Dell, I think it's a 10.1.
Yeah.
Running Microsoft. And I want to hook up a Vizio 40 or 46 inch, whatever, something in that range, probably.
Yeah.
I got a feeling they'll be able to tell me what I
It is quite likely. They'll probably want model numbers.
You will get better quality out of VGA or HDMI. I've got a list of zillions of connectors.
Oh, nice.
You'll get better quality from VGA or HDMI than you will from component. But if that's all the device has to output from, then that's what you're stuck with.
HDMI, did you say? That
yeah.
Sounds...
Yeah, HDMI is the new high-definition multimedia interface.
That's exactly what it is.
And designed for flat-screen TVs, almost all use HDMI now.
So you may have multiple HDMI inputs on your television.
Well, I haven't got a television. I got two televisions in the house, and they're old CT.
Oh, right. But if you're going to get a new television, it will certainly have HDMI and may not have component. Mm. So check the back of your computer to see if it has an HDMI connector. That would certainly be a much better alternative if you're looking to have a second screen or even as your main screen.
I would assume that I should be able to switch it so I could just use one or the other.
Yes.
Yep.
Or both simultaneously.
And that would probably be better anyway.
Right.
My web link is it's pretty darn good, but... In fact, I can't believe how good it does work, but I just wanted to get some feeling for what that would do and so on, because just to watch television, I haven't turned on a television in this house and since before Barack Obama was even heard of.
Yeah.
No, I'm not kidding you. I sometimes use my computer and I watch a little video stuff on that, but my vision isn't worth a hoot anyway.
And many of the TV stations and video content providers now, because they're not all TV stations anymore, have web streams, so you don't even need a television.
Right.
Mm. You can use a monitor with a computer.
Right. But what your best bet is to take a look at the back of the monitor and inventory all the outputs. Because you may well have multiple outputs, component, DVI, HDMI. Mm-hmm. And then when you go to buy a television, check the back of it as well, and then you'll be able to tell what you can match up.
Well, what I'm going to have to do, I think, is get some help, and then I can get my computer out from where it is and dust it off real good.
There you go. Good luck.
And then take a camera and take a photo of the back, the connections, and then I take that with me to the store.
Perfect.
Right. That's what I thought.
There you go.
Yep. Well, good luck with the snow.
Thanks. You
Thank
too.
You, yeah.
Yeah, I may need it.
Yeah, you may need it. Yeah.
Because I think the angle is coming. I think I might be in a lot more trouble than you guys.
I think you actually are down there. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, have a good one.
You too. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Yep, thanks. Bye.
Yeah, it depends on where you are in the path.
The path of the storm, but this is it's a heck of a storm coming. Now it goes from Lake Ontario to the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing storm. We'll see what happens. I believe I'm gonna snuggle down after the show. You're welcome, America. We actually came here in this horrible weather. to provide you with the finest computer assistance you'll get all day, unless you go to one of the good dealers in town and speak to them directly. Yeah.
And I just found a really cool picture, better than the one I had earlier, of all the different types of audio and video connectors. So we got tip, ring, sleeve, tip, ring, ring, sleeve.
Right, right, right. Yeah, post that. That's a great site.
The coax connector. So S-Video was a way to make a super quality video in the old analog days. So that was better than composite and component.
Right.
And it ran on one cable, which was great.
When I did television for a while, I had a laptop with an S-Video out, and they had S-Video in so that they could actually take my signal, which... in a lot of places, they didn't. A lot of cases, they couldn't otherwise.
I remember buying an S-Video VHS recorder.
Oh, yeah.
It was like double the price of regular, but it was higher quality.
Yep.
But then my TV couldn't display it any higher quality, so.
No, you kind of forget there's a whole chain that has to all work together.
I had an enhanced definition television, a CRT for a while, before... before the HD came out. It was better than SD, but not all the way to HD. It was ED, enhanced definition.
Right, I remember those.
And then I had ED later. No.
Right, right. Separate story for another day. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Scott from Rochester, New York. Hiya, Scott. What's up?
Hello, Nick. And how are you guys doing?
We're good. How are you doing?
Not bad. Staying in today.
That's how it works.
I haven't called your show in about 25 years, but it...
Well, we missed
I got
you,
rid
Scott.
Of my Windows machines.
Right.
So right now I'm having a problem with printing on a Chromebook. I've got two Chromebooks. The Samsung that I have, it's a newer one. When I select black and white, it still wants to print in color. I've got an Epson, XP410 printer. And so, you know, it seems like it's the Chromebook causing the problem, because my Acer Chromebook, it will print in black and white when I select that. So I wondered if you had any ideas.
Get a black-only printer?
Right.
Sorry.
So you've got two Chromebooks. One prints fine.
Yep.
In black and white, but... But the other one will not. What it sounds like is that shouldn't matter at this point. Are there two different generations of Chromebooks?
Well, the Acer is probably about 5 years old, and I just got the Samsung maybe 4 or 5 months ago, six months ago.
Yeah. Are you doing this by cloud print or direct?
Well, getting it set up was a bit of a problem. I had a little help with that. So, to be honest with you, I'm not sure. Is there a place where I could verify that?
Well, you should be. Well, look. Here's the thing. Let me just cut to the chase. What might be the case is that 5 years ago, when you set up the other printer. The other computer with that printer, there were a limited number of drivers available for Chromebooks.
Uh-huh.
Now there are many more.
Okay.
So what you may be able to do with the older machine is forget the printer and then reattach it, and it will use a newer, better driver.
Okay, but I wasn't clear. It's the newer one that won't print in black and white.
Oh.
And it was fine before. When I first set it up, it was printing in black and white when I chose that. And then all of a sudden, it seemed to, on its own, not want to.
Ah, okay. I don't have a color printer, so I don't know exactly how this quite works. But if you go to print something... it brings up the print dialog box, and at the bottom of on the left, it says more settings.
If you look, all right.
If you open that up, what you and again, I don't have a color printer, so I don't know if this is where it is. But what you theoretically will see is one of the choices is print in black and white or color.
Right.
It and there is also an advanced printer options at the bottom, which includes even more features. So you may need to go into there. But the point is, once you've set one, say, let's say you set it to color at some point, accidentally, on purpose, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
From then on, it will always remember that until you change it again. So if it used to work and now it doesn't, it is quite likely that at some point, whether you did it on purpose or by accident, it sounds like you changed the essentially the default from black and white to color. And now you just need to find out how to do it, put it back.
That's what I need to find out, yeah.
Yeah. And, so when you go to print something, that print box comes up, and there, at the bottom of the left-hand column is more settings.
Okay, I'm going there right now, and the only choices I have are paper size, margins, scale, and then under options, there's headers and footers, background graphics, and selection only.
All right. Is there an advanced printer options underneath that?
No. That's it.
It almost sounds like the wrong driver's loaded.
Hmm.
But
well,
it prints,
but it prints using this driver, I guess. But
right. It prints. It should print fine. You just can't not print in color.
It doesn't have the extra options that you would expect.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know. If you go to change at the top, it should say your destination and your printer name.
Right.
Yep. Underneath that is change.
Yeah, there's under change. Well, I can save as PDF, and then it's got several of my Epson options here. And save to Google Drive.
Right. But you might, if you have multiple printers, it may be that it essentially thinks that the black and white is a separate printer.
Oh, no, I only have one printer.
Oh, okay. Then at this point, I'm afraid somebody's going to have to sit down in front of it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't quite know what to tell you. I would have thought it would be in that list, but I'm sorry.
When's the next Rochester Google's meeting?
Yeah, bring your Chromebook to the next Rochester Google's meeting. It's the first Thursday of every month at St. John's Meadow.
St. John's Meadow.
So we've already had it this month.
Yeah, we already had it this month. It was the first Thursday.
Oh, all right. Like 7 p.m. or so?
7 p.m.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, thanks.
Bring your Chromebook. We'll take a look at it.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Take care now.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, sometimes, unfortunately, you can't do it without the printer in front of you or the system in front of you.
And in this case, probably both.
Probably both wouldn't be bad, but I don't expect him to actually bring his entire computer over.
Although most printers are pretty small these days. We often run into customers that do that. They bring their computer in and they say they're having trouble printing. I can print fine to my printer. You got to bring your printer too.
Right.
And it's usually because it wasn't plugged in or the driver is wrong, and neither of which we can fix without having the printer there too.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Tom from Brighton, New York. Hi, Tom. What's up?
Yeah, hi. I've got an older Lenovo laptop, one of the ThinkPads.
Yeah.
It's a L520, and it's about 8 or 9 years old. And it's always worked very well. It still works well. But lately, it's been turning off rather suddenly. Like every couple of days, it'll just go black and turn itself off. I assume it's some kind of an overheating issue. And I'm wondering, what I could do about it.
Well, first thing is to make sure that your fans are clear.
Yeah, they are. I did check that. So,
Can you hear that the fans are still running?
Yes. I can feel on the side of the laptop, there's some vents that allow you to,
Right, and you can feel the air coming. Right, you can feel the air.
Yeah.
And is the air overly warm?
It's always been warm, to be quite honest.
It's not
burning hot or anything, but it's definitely on the warm side.
Well, one thing you can do, and Tom, you're now nursing an 8 or 9 year old laptop, Okay, let's start with that. But one thing you can do is to buy, there are any number of pads you can put under it that are cooling pads. Steve mm-hmm. has one here. The one I bought for my wife actually raises it up and has fans that blow underneath it.
I need to put one under my adapter dongle because that gets really hot.
You really
Let's
do.
Let's not put the paper on top of that there, yeah, Mike.
Right. 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 That certainly will help. Adding an external fan blowing across the back might help.
Yeah.
But you're really at the point where, you know, they're not... 9 years is a long time.
Well, you know, I use it mostly for internet surfing, and for that, it's just fine. You know, I don't do too much even word processing anymore.
Right, right. No, I get it. But what I'm saying is, it's hardware dies.
Yeah.
You know, and it may well be that what's happening is that on many older machines, the heat sink that's attached to the chip is attached with a glue.
Right.
And 9 years on, that glue may be loosening up.
If yeah. you're handy with a screwdriver,
I could
and
do
don't
that.
Care.
Yeah, I am, yeah. But I think with a laptop, it's not quite the same as with, say, a desktop computer.
Right. Well, oftentimes the heat, laptops are harder to get into, but the heat sinks are usually the same thing put on with thermal paste.
Okay.
Well, right. They look exactly the same. It's just getting to it that's going to be harder.
Yeah. You know, I've actually taken the bottom off it once or twice before, so I could take a look at that again.
Yeah, but it is certainly possible that the problem is the heat sink is no longer firmly attached.
Yeah. It's been a great machine.
I have an ancient Lenovo ThinkPad, and it is an amazing machine. And they built them, you know, they bought the design from IBM and didn't change it. And they built like tanks.
Yeah, they are.
You know, it's an amazing device, but... 8 or 9 years on, I don't know that I trust it.
Okay, I'll give it a try.
Yep, thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And even an external one of those little fans you use in the summer.
Sure. It can't hurt to try it, at least. Yep. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 32 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites, right here on the Truly Great, and continuing to be truly grateful to you that we can be member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 36 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and I am amused when they say the high temperature is going to be 7. Just the way he kind of dropped it. High temperature on Monday, 7.
That's negative forever for your Canadian
That's
friends.
Right. That's right. We don't use Celsius. We use Freedom Height. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Larry from Penfield, New York. Hi, Larry. What's up?
Hi, guys. I have a question about my Chromebook.
Yeah.
Every now and then, it's happened several times now, when I'm using it, all of a sudden, the window with several tabs open in it will just disappear. And if I go into history and look for it, it's not there. And I looked, did some searching, and... as near as I can tell from what they were saying, it sounds like it's a bug in the software. You have any experience with that?
I have not experienced it myself, no. Nor have I heard of other people with that particular issue. When was the last time you rebooted your Chromebook? Because I just got an update. I mean, literally during the break, during the 3-minute break. I updated my Chromebook.
I think it was sometime within the last week. But.
Yeah. Okay. Let me think. And when you say a window with several tabs, you mean the browser window?
Right.
It just shuts itself off.
Well, that open window goes away, and it's not there anymore.
Right, it's not at the bottom of the screen. If you click on the little Google icon at the bottom, it doesn't open back up again?
I couldn't find it anywhere. There were a couple times when it went away like that, and then just later, all of a sudden, it popped back.
Didn't go behind, did it?
And what would it go behind?
Because there is only one modal window. You can't have another window behind it.
No, you can have multiple windows. Do you have other windows open at the time?
Yes.
It may be that it's gone behind it. Across the bottom of your screen, you have some icons. Is one of them the Google wheel? The little green, red, and yellow wheel with a blue center?
Right. And I looked in there, and it wasn't listed in there.
Okay, so when you clicked on that, it came up blank.
Well, there were other windows, but it wasn't not the one that I was looking for.
Okay, so you have multiple versions of the Chrome window open.
Yes.
Okay, so Alt-Tab didn't cycle through more of them?
Actually didn't try that.
Yeah, try that, because if you have Windows... Hello, hi. Chrome works very much like Windows does. If you have multiple windows open, you can use Alt-Tab to cycle through them just the way you do in Windows. And if for example, you've got multiple windows of the Chrome browser open, and one of them updates, it may come to the front, hiding the other window.
Oh.
In which case, you bring the other window back with just an Alt-Tab.
Well, that sounds easy.
Yeah, if that's the issue.
Okay, I'll give that a try next time that happens.
Yeah, I think you may find that's your issue right there. It didn't disappear; it just went behind. And if you don't know the little magic Alt-Tab works in Chromebooks as well, you wouldn't know to do that to see if you could find it.
Okay. Another question while I have you here. When you go from, say, a Chromebook to Linux, besides the obvious of the automatic cloud backup and being able to run Android apps, what else are you giving up to make that transition?
Nothing. Here's why. You can still run the Chrome browser in Linux and still do all the same things you do on a Chromebook, because Chromebook is really just the Chrome browser running in its own little mini Linux operating system. So if you've got a Linux desktop, you're right. You don't get Android apps. You, of course, get the full suite of Linux programs that you can run instead. But you can still run Chrome, and you can still run all of the extensions that you've added to Chrome.
Okay.
So, for example, just to give you a simple combination of things that I do, I use Google Keep on both devices. I use Google Photos on both devices. I use the Chrome operating system on both devices. So I do, you know, all the writing that I do, I often do it on my Linux box because it's got a much nicer keyboard and I've got carpal tunnel. So I do most of my writing on that, but I still do it all in Google Docs so that when I take my Chromebook out, I still have access to everything. And the same with all the spreadsheets that I do and all the presentations that I give and all of that stuff. I do it all in Google Docs. But in addition, there are a few things that I do that I haven't found an equivalent for on my Chromebook, mainly because I just don't look. For example, the slicer for my 3D printer is a Linux program, but I only ever slice anything when I'm home anyway, so it doesn't matter. The slicer prepares things to be 3D printed. And I haven't needed that on my Chromebook, so I haven't looked for that yet. But the number of things that you can do on a Linux box that you can't do on a Chromebook are very, very tiny. And in many cases, you can do all the same things. The big difference will be, as you pointed out, the Android apps.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you can almost always find Linux equivalents for those Android apps, except for certain games.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too. And that's a very good question. When you're switching from any operating system to any other operating system, the important question to ask is what changes? What do I give up? What can't I do? In this particular case, the difference is quite minimal.
But it will look different, and you may. So it depends. It depends on how similar you can go without being freaked out. So
right.
So if the button color changes from green to lime, will that freak you out?
Right.
Was that when you had one of those where the button color changed and everything was different?
Everything was different. They couldn't do it because the icon had changed. It was a different color and it was a slightly different shape. Of course, now I had some Chrome people who were very confused because at one point the very early on the icons were square with rounded corners and now they're round.
With square corners?
With no corners. They're round. They're round. And so people had a lot of difficulty looking at that new look. And then they changed the color scheme and everything else. But it looks lovely and vibrant now. So people got used to it pretty quickly. Okay, back to the phones. Our next caller is Tim from Webster, New York. Hiya, Tim. What's up? Tim, you there?
No, this is Ken.
Ken! Sorry, Ken, where from?
Webster.
Okay, I was half right.
Okay.
Okay, good for me. What's up, Ken?
Well, I'm calling for my benefit and also possibly to the benefit of a gentleman you talked a little while ago.
Okay.
This was the gentleman, of, I believe, that couldn't, with the new printer, print in black.
Right.
Okay. I do a lot of printing, both color and black and white. And what I'm going to tell you, I have a Chrome box, I have a Chrome book, but I have not tried to hook up a printer to either one of those yet. One of the reasons, like I told you, I'm calling, I might learn something out of the dialogue that I have with you.
Yeah.
But here's what I want to say. Right now, I could be in Windows. I am in Windows, but I'm in Chrome, okay?
Sure.
I got the Google page. I'm staring at it right now.
Mm-hmm.
I could have anything of my liking, but this page, I'm going to right-click it, and I'm going to hit print.
Sure.
Okay. Now, the window that opens up, it says how many copies do I want? Do I want to do it in landscape, black and white? Or color.
Right.
I can make that choice. So I would think, of course, he's doing with a Chromebook.
Right.
I can change it from black and white to color.
Right.
And there's another way to do it. Just below that, it says print using the system dialog, which that's Control-Shift-P.
Right.
But another thing you can do, you can click that box open, and now I get a window that says print. And in that window, find a printer, and above that is preferences.
Right.
That's a good thing. A different printer will give you different options.
Right. This is a Canon 7220. So I clicked preferences. Now, if I want to print this way, if I just went ahead and printed, it's all set up right now for photo paper plus glossy, high quality.
Sure.
But if I want to shortcut that, I just go up to additional features and I click grayscale printing.
Yep.
And hit OK. And now it prints in black.
Right. The difference, Ken, is that the drivers for Windows are very different from the drivers for Chromebooks.
I realize that.
And that's why Scott was not seeing those same kinds of options on the Chromebook.
So when, let me just back up. This will be my learning experience.
Right.
When I right-click the Google page and it says print, the window that comes up, he's not even seeing that window?
It's a different dialog box because it's a different operating system.
And there's none of those selections to pick?
Some of them, but not the one that says color or black and white. Although, he sparked something. It may not say black and white. It may say gray. Grayscale.
It may say gray.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right. It may say grayscale instead of black and white. But the reality is I unfortunately don't have a color printer, so I can't see those options, and I've never had experience with changing from black and white to color.
Okay.
And so I can't lead him to that, but theoretically any driver, and in fact it works properly on his other Chromebook.
Yeah, I remember him saying that.
So it's clearly something on that one Chromebook, and really at this point somebody's got to sit down in front of it to see what that might be.
That's true. Well, I'm sorry I couldn't help, but the only last thing I will say this. Back, I'm 78 years old. Back in the day when I was, long, long time ago, I got into photography.
Yep.
So, as far as I'm concerned, my computer is as important to me as my car because I do a lot with photography.
Sure.
So there isn't a day goes by that I'm not printing in black and white or color.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Absolutely.
Okay. But, one last thing. You said something listening to your show about Windows 7. I don't want you to get into a long dialogue about it, but it's only going to be supported for one more year?
Yep. Next January, it's gone.
Okay. Yep. I have to buy another Chromebook.
There you go. You've got a year to set up your printing on your Chromebooks.
What's that?
You've got a year to set up your printing on your Chromebooks.
Well, it's that's one bad thing. I'm going to rattle somebody's cage out there. If you've never bought a Chromebook or a Chromebox, it can be a little bit tricky getting the printer hooked up to it. And I've talked to friends that have done it. It's too bad that couldn't have been a little made simpler.
They've been making it simpler as they go, but it's not as easy yet as it could be.
And the problem is that every printer has its own language.
Correct.
Basically.
Right. Correct. Yep. In fact, if you buy a printer that's something different than what you've used, you'll find language on the setup page that isn't going to be anything like you've seen in the past.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I know.
All right, thanks,
guys.
Ken.
Thanks a lot.
Yep, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've even had customers have problems when they have two different models of the same brand printer.
Yes.
The drivers will fight each other because they're different drivers.
Yep, that's exactly right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Tim from Webster, New York, who we thought we had earlier. Hiya, Tim. What's up?
Yeah, hi, guys. I may have to call back next week on this, but I'll try to squeeze this in.
Okay.
I have a folder on my desktop, so I open up the folder to look for something. I've had this problem for years. I go in the search bar. If I have something in that folder called Kitten Cute, and I search for cute, nothing comes up. So I say to myself, okay, it's only going to accept the first word for me to be able to find what I'm looking for. So I type in kitten, and what I'm looking for comes right up. So I try something else, like music, Neil Diamond. I type in Neil, and it works.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why it works sometimes, why it doesn't work other times.
It's searching for a word starts with.
But in the music Neil Diamond, I put in Neil, and it worked.
Okay, so let me ask another question. Do you have it set to check only the case that you've put in?
I don't
know. Case sensitive? For example, if Kitten Cute is capital K, capital C, and you're searching for cute lowercase...
I don't know if this will help you, but I did type in lowercase Neil. That's right in front of me right now. So lowercase N-E-I-L, and that came up, even though the notepad is called Music capital N-E-I-L, Diamond.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I've been dealing with this for years, I think, on all of my computers. So I'm like, I got to call you guys and find out what is the trick to the darn search bar.
You may need to rebuild the search index.
Can I ask you to do one simple thing? Which is to that Kitten Cute folder or document or whatever you've got. Can you just rename it the same thing, Kitten Cute again, but wipe out the old Kitten Cute? And here's why I say that. It is possible to put a hidden character in it. accidentally, if you fumble finger something while you're typing, and that hidden character, you won't see it, but it counts in the search.
Now, I think I understand what you mean. For the record, I rarely put spaces in anything that I label. I don't know if that helps.
No, well, it wouldn't be a space. It would be a hidden character. You may have accidentally typed a control something, and that puts an invisible character in the word cute, say.
Is it at all possible that, like, the previous file was a text document and the kitten cute is like a WebM thing of a kitten? So would it matter if it's a different, whole different kind of...
No, it should bring up all of the things with cute in them. So my suggestion is, and I don't fight me on this, rename it.
And see what happens.
And
you're saying that in
rename it to exactly the same thing, but... rename it and see if that solves the problem. You may have a hidden character on that.
And rename it the same thing.
Yeah, exactly the same thing.
And you're saying that in the file that is the Music Neil, it is Music Neil, it's not Music Space Neil.
Exactly.
It doesn't do a search word contains.
Right.
Right. But I've seen problems where the search is starts with, not contains.
Right. Make sure it's contains but not starts with.
Yeah.
And rename that kitten cute file and see what happens.
If that doesn't work, you might need to re-index the folder, which I posted a link on how to re-index
your
folders.
Right, you may need to re-index the whole folder.
Are you guys on YouTube this week?
Yep.
We are.
Will you upload that in the next week or so?
It's there now.
Well, the YouTube is up live at the moment. The podcast will be up tomorrow. And the link is available right now on our website.
Awesome. Okay, thanks for your time, guys. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
That music tells me we are done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to apologize to all those of you who we did not get to. Please call earlier next week. Good luck with the snow. Stay inside. Snuggle up with somebody warm, and we'll see. There's no. We're going to do a special presentation of special music for the next couple of hours, next few hours. So, but don't go away. Regular programming will resume after that. And we will be back next week with probably Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. I want to thank Michael Oden. He was amazing this week, keeping us on the straight and narrow as only he can. And we'll be back to see you next week on the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. It's Soundbites right here on the Truly Great. And truly grateful to you that we are member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you in 166 hours.